crash, mass, mass, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We run the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, 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 we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Anthony Fess. Mickey Huff is taking the week off with his family. Today's show, we interview internationally known author Lillian Faderman regarding her new book, The Gay Revolution. The Gay Revolution provides readers, for the first time, a history of the entire LGBT civil rights movement from its inception in the 1950s up through the current day. We'll end the show with an update on gay and lesbian rights from Caitlin McCoy of Marin College of Students for Social Justice. We hope you stay tuned.
Habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Anthony Fest. Mickey Huff is taking the week off with his family. Lillian Faderman is an internationally known scholar of lesbian history and literature, as well as ethnic history, and her new book, The Gay Revolution, is a New York Times editor's choice. Her work's been translated in numerous languages, including German, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Turkish, Czech, and Slovakian. Among her many honors are 6 Lambda Literary Awards and 2 American Library Association Awards and several lifetime achievements of scholarship, including Yale University James Bruner A. Award. Welcome to the show, Lillian.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Lillian, tell us what compelled you to write this. It's a 600-page book. I've really enjoyed going through it. It's a detailed history of the gay-lesbian movements of civil rights, going back to the 1940s. What has compelled you to put so much energy into this work?
Well, LGBT history has been my passion since the 1970s, and I've written a number of books that deal with those subjects. The reason I wanted to write this book, though, is that the progress that we've made in recent years has been really phenomenal. And I think a lot of people who don't know LGBT history think it happened overnight. One day we were pariahs, and the next day we were allowed to get married all over the country. What I wanted to show is that it didn't happen overnight. It was really a almost 70-year organized struggle to achieve our rights, and it's often been very hard going. There have been numerous setbacks and many wonderful victories, and I wanted to trace that. I wanted to show how we got from being criminals and crazies and sinners and subversives, as we were considered in the mid-20th century, to almost first-class American citizens now. Not quite, but almost.
Lily, your book really starts with the 1940s and the repressive laws that were in place, the firings of professors and people in government if they were discovered to be homosexual or lesbian. But did we have a kinder, gentler nation before that? Was it more accepted? What was called Boston marriages, I'm aware of, were recognized women as partners. Tell us a little background on that history.
Well, open homosexuality was always persecuted from the time it was called sodomy in the colonial era all the way through the mid-20th century. What I try to show in other books is that lesbians and gays still carried on their lives, but they did it surreptitiously. They did it underground. I think that in the early 20th century, the late 19th century as well, middle-class women who loved other women were really able to hide very well in what was called Boston marriages. That is, most people in the outside world assumed that these middle-class professional women chose to live with one another because it was more convenient, because if they wanted to pursue the careers that were opening up for women in the late 19th and early 20th century, they couldn't possibly get married and have numerous children in those days before sophisticated birth control. So of course they would want to live with another woman who was in the same kind of situation. There was even a term for those relationships, and that was Boston marriage. Many of those Boston marriages were, of course, what we would call lesbian today. And women whose names I think most of your listeners would be familiar with, because they were so important in early 20th century American history, lived in those so-called Boston marriages. Jane Addams, who was virtually the founder of social work and the idea of the early settlement houses, Jane Addams lived for many years in a Boston marriage with Mary Rosett Smith. One of the early women's college presidents, M. Carey Thomas, lived for years in a Boston marriage. The president of Mount Holyoke for 30 years, Mary Woolley, lived for about 50 years until her death in a Boston marriage with a woman who was a professor at Mount Holyoke. And I think the outside world generally thought that these were just asexual relationships of convenience, but as I try to document in my earlier books, such as Surpassing the Love of Men and Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers and To Believe in Women, those were not simply relationships of convenience, because there are extant love letters between the women that show that although they wouldn't have used the word lesbian for themselves, they were certainly lesbian relationships as we understand them today.
Lillian, this is Anthony Fest. You've spoken about Boston marriages here, but it sounds like this was something which was permitted for women. There were no so-called Boston marriages for men. Is that correct?
I think it really has to do with perceptions of the differences between male and female sexuality in other eras. It was never doubted that two men could be sexual together, as we see from early persecutions of so-called sodomites all the way back to colonial times. I think that in the Victorian era, particularly, most of society didn't want to grant the fact that women could be sexually autonomous. That is, they wanted to believe that middle-class women, in any case, were sexually pure and certainly would do their duties in the marital bed, but wouldn't on their own be sexually aggressive. And so the notion of two women together being sexual was something that was seldom entertained in the Western world. So I think that explains why women were thought, if they formed relationships, were thought to engage in these platonic Boston marriages, but the same kind of notion couldn't be entertained about two men together.
Now, you open your book with the post-World War II gay rights movement. Give us a quick sketch, and I guess, would it be correct to say that movement as a phase of LGBT history could be traced from the 40s and through most of the 1960s?
I think that gay and lesbian communities burgeoned around America as a result of World War II. There was a huge shift in population at that time. Men who weren't drafted and many women moved to big cities for the defense industry. Men who were drafted and women who volunteered for the military, if they came from small towns or farms all over America, learned about big cities because that's where they would have R&R. And I think what happened is that after the war, people who were lesbian or gay, the preferred term was homosexual as far as the outside world was concerned. Among lesbians and gays and people that we would today call transgender, the underground term was gay for all of us. But these gay people, men and women, came back to these big cities that they had learned about during World War II, and gay communities burgeoned in places like New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Chicago and even places like Atlanta. The community burgeoned and hostility towards homosexuals burgeoned as well. And so the gay bars that were established in the post-World War II years were very often raided by police because the gay male population was so big. And in many of the big cities, the vice squads decided that they would hire undercover officers to entrap homosexual men, very often to come on to them, and if they responded, to arrest them. They would do stakeouts in homosexual cruising places in the years after the war. And persecution really burgeoned, as well as the expansion of these gay and lesbian populations. I think that before the 1940s, homosexuality in America was often, as Lord Alfred Douglas said, in England in the Victorian era, the love that dared not speak its name. After World War II, with the growth of these gay communities, homosexuality often made the newspapers in very negative kinds of ways.
And then in the 1950s, we have the best-known early gay rights groups. The organizations whose names come to mind are the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis. Give us a quick sketch of what these groups were about, please.
Yes, because of all the persecution in the post-World War II years, in Los Angeles, a man by the name of Harry Hay, who had been a member of the Communist Party, realized that homosexuals were a minority, no less than ethnic and religious minorities. And he called together a small group of people, all men in the beginning, and he told them that we are an oppressed cultural minority and we need to organized to fight against our oppression. That was really virtually the first time anyone had said that in the United States. Actually, in 1924, a man by the name of Henry Gerber in Chicago made a similar formulation and tried to form a group of homosexual men. It didn't last very long. The police found out about it within months, and it was broken up. But Harry Hay called these men together, and they started an organization called Mattachine. And that did last for a couple of decades. It wasn't very huge, but at least it was the beginning of gay organizing with this understanding that homosexuals are, as Harry Hay said, an oppressed cultural minority. So Mattachine was the first organization, and that started in Los Angeles in 1950. And there were a number of branches of Mattachine all over the United States. And in 1955, a group of women decided they would form a social organization, a secret social organization. They would call themselves the Daughters of Bilitis. There were about eight women in the beginning. All of them dropped out, but Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, who carried on the Daughters of Bilitis, and that was an organization that lasted for about 20 years as well and had branches in various places around the country.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest with Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff will be back next week. Today we're speaking with Lillian Faderman, LGBT historian. She has a new book out, The Gay Revolution. We'll be back right after this music break. And welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest with Peter Phillips, and our guest today is Lillian Faderman. Peter?
Lillian, I'd like to ask about the impact that Alfred Kinsey's reports in 1948 had, because I think for the first time after interviewing thousands of individuals, we had some idea that homosexuals were large numbers of people.
Yes, and I think that was one of the inspirations for Harry Hay to start Mattachine, the first ongoing homophile organization, as such gay groups were called in the 1950s. Harry Hay realized that, as Kinsey said, that about 10% of the population was gay at any given time, and there would be a constituency, and there would be a number of people who would identify with his notion that homosexuals were an oppressed cultural minority. So that was a big inspiration for Harry Hay to start the first homophile organization.
I think we had an awareness, and when we say 10%, I mean that's at any specific time, but for the bisexuality of very large numbers of people who engaged in sex with both men and women,
like,
perhaps.
Like, 37% of American men had some sort of sexual relationship with another male. That was huge. It, of course, upset people who didn't want to understand that homosexuality was not limited to a tiny minority skulking in the shadows, but a lot of men had homosexual experiences. And that, as I said, was a real inspiration for Harry Hay to call together a group of homophiles who would begin to fight for their rights.
We're speaking with LGBT historian Lillian Faderman. Lillian, in June of 1969, we have an event which arguably changed everything. And that, of course, was the Stonewall Rebellion in New York, probably the best-known event in gay history. Police raids of gay bars were the norm then, even in New York. But the people in that bar that evening had enough. They started fighting back, started throwing bottles, and then a riot ensued. And then it went on for a couple more nights in Greenwich Village. So tell us about that momentous event in LGBT history.
It was called by one gay wit the hairpin drop heard round the world. And it did make a huge difference because Stonewall became an icon, and it made the papers as earlier organizing like the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis and Frank Kameny, who picketed the White House with a number of people, and the Pentagon, and picketed the Civil Service Commission. Frank Kameny got some attention, but nothing like Stonewall. It became iconic, and I think that was really a beginning for a militant gay movement. As a result of Stonewall, the Gay Liberation Front formed, and that was the first radical gay group that had any traction. Out of that, another group called the Gay Activist Alliance formed, and they really focused on civil rights for gay people. And out of that, mainstreaming groups formed, such as the National Gay Task Force, which wanted not only local civil rights for gay people, like the Gay Activist Alliance worked on a New York city ordinance, but the National Gay Task Force saw itself as a national group that would fight eventually for same-sex marriage and the right to be included in the military openly, and they would fight for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and now for transgender rights. But that was the first group that really saw itself as having some kind of potential for national clout.
Now, Stonewall actually was spontaneous, whereas some events in American history that are mistakenly depicted as spontaneous, like Rosa Parks keeping her seat on the bus, were in fact part of a carefully organized campaign, but Stonewall was indeed spontaneous. And another curious thing is that the names of those who fought back are not household words today, even in our LGBT community. Did you seek out some of them for your book?
I did. did. I spoke to a number of people who had been there at the riots and active in the riots, like John O'Brien, who was a young radical who had been waiting for something like that all of his life, I think. And that was probably the case with many of the people who fought back. Their anger had built throughout their young adulthood. John O'Brien at that time was 19 years old, and many of these kids who fought in the Stonewall riots were about that age, 17, 18, 19, maybe 20. But what I think needs to be remembered about Stonewall is it happened in June of 1969, virtually at the end of a decade that was full of violent, active protests. The black civil rights movement that very often turned into riots because of frustration, the anti-Vietnam War movement that was very dramatic and brought many people out, and that sometimes turned into riots, the feminist movement that was full of colorful protests, particularly the radical feminist movement. There was a Chicano movement. There was a Native American movement, even an Asian American movement throughout the 1960s. And finally, virtually at the end of the decade, gay people realized that they were oppressed and needed to fight back just as other minorities were fighting back. And I think that was in the psyche of Stonewall. That was somehow part of the reason that the riots happened, because gay people, too, had enough and wanted to make a dramatic protest saying that.
Lillian, I want to ask, historically, the military banned gays back right after World War One. I mean, had it been a strong position that you were drummed out of the Corps, so to speak, if you were identified. And, of course, people that worked in government were often fired. And your story about E.K. Johnson, a professor at Missouri in 1948, he was like chair of the communications department, was fired for homosexual behavior. And at that time, the American Psychiatric Association, declared that homosexuals were sick. They were psychopathic, and all of which, of course, has no foundation in truth or whatsoever. But as the movement emerged for civil rights, for LGBT, there was a strong resistance in many cases from people like Phyllis Schlafly and Anita Bryant and the church. And I remember a debate at Santa Clara University in the 60s whether or not LGBT people could love each other. It was actually quite interesting for me at the time. I thought, well, of course they can. So those kinds of issues were emerging. Talk a little bit about the resistance and the forces in resistance to this.
The resistance reared its head almost as soon as organizing began. When Harry Hay organized the Mattachine Society in Los Angeles in the early 1950s, it was found by Paul Coates, who was a journalist in Los Angeles at that time, that Hay and others had belonged to the Communist Party. And of course, he wrote these terrible editorials about these sick homosexuals who were not only pink, they're red as well. But I think the resistance became even more virulent once it looked as though gay people would get their rights. And so in the first part of the 1970s, gay people succeeded in getting the number of cities to pass ordinances that would add homosexuals to existing ordinances of non-discrimination of various other minorities, like people of color and handicapped people and such. One of the biggest dramas of resistance took place in Miami, in Dade County, when finally in 1977 the Miami Board of Supervisors passed resolution, adding, it didn't even say sexual orientation, it said affectional preference to a non-discrimination ordinance. Anita Bryant, who was a pop singer and a fundamentalist, lived in Miami, and she immediately organized against that ordinance, organized to have it repealed. It was repealed in June of 1977, and that gave Anita Bryant and other right-wingers like her the stamina to organize all over the country. And so very soon after that, ordinances in St. Paul, Minnesota, and Wichita, Kansas, and Eugene, Oregon were repealed. And it also gave Senator John Briggs in California the inspiration to get what was called the Briggs Initiative onto the California ballot. And the Briggs Initiative said that not only homosexuals, but anyone who said anything nice about homosexuals, who worked in the public school as either a teacher or an administrator or any job in the public schools, could be fired. And it really looked as though the Briggs Initiative would pass. Early polls seemed to be saying that the Briggs Initiative would pass by a landslide. The gay community up and down California really managed to organize and to defeat the Briggs Initiative. And I think that stopped in its tracks, at least for a while, this movement of these fundamentalists and right-wingers against any kind of gay progress.
And then, of course, we have gay people starting to be elected to public office, most notably Harvey Milk, who, of course, was then assassinated. Then we come to the 1980s and AIDS. A few months after Ronald Reagan takes office, doctors start reporting this mysterious deadly disease that's striking gay men, which would later be named AIDS. Reagan goes through his first term without publicly uttering the word AIDS. You know, thousands die, and there's an angry new breed of activism challenging the slow-moving federal health agencies and different politicians. Then there's the Gay Rights March on Washington in 1987. But would you say that this period of history continued until the mid-1990s, when at last protease inhibitors became available?
There was actually an earlier march on Washington, a gay and lesbian march on Washington, and that is in 1979. And it happened really out of the great tragedy of Harvey Milk's assassination. He had wanted such a march, and it just wasn't being organized. But as a result of his murder, gay people said that, yes, we have to have a march. And that was a very unifying factor in the gay and lesbian community. But I think you're right about the effect of AIDS. It was, of course, the worst devastating tragedy to ever hit the community. But it also meant that the community learned more about organizing, and organizing was essential because, as you point out, the president wouldn't even mention AIDS, and the Center for Disease Control came up with a solution that people who tested positively should be quarantined. That didn't last very long because there was so much protest of the organized gay community against that. But I think that as a result of the tragedy of the epidemic, gay people learned to organize better. They learned to protest more effectively. They learned to work together as they very often had not before. And another thing happened as a result of it. I think that more and more people came out of the closet. They realized that in the face of such a tragedy, there was no place in the closet anymore. They had to come out and fight openly. And, of course, many gay men came out involuntarily because of the signs of the disease. But as more people came out, not only gay men, but lesbians had not wanted to work with gay men during the radical lesbian feminist 1970s, but in the face of an epidemic, they realized that this was no time for divisiveness, and so it was lesbians who started many food banks. It was lesbians who helped gay men navigate the medical system that they very often knew well because they had been in positions such as nurses and worked within the medical system. So more and more people came out of the closet, and I think that this coming out of the closet has really made all of the difference in our successes and finally achieving more than a modicum of civil rights. Because if straight people realize that homosexuals are not those people skulking in the shadows, but they're our brothers and sisters and sons and daughters and aunts and uncles, it's a little harder for them to maintain the prejudices that they'd so unthinkingly adhered to. So coming out of the closet as a result of the epidemic, I think, has made a huge difference.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Anthony Fest with Peter Phillips. Our guest today is Lillian Faderman, who has a new history out of the gay movement. It's called The Gay Revolution. We'll be back right after this music break. And welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest with Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff returns next week. Today's guest is Lillian Faderman. She has a new history out, The Gay Revolution. It's a look at the LGBT movement from the post-World War II years right up until today. Peter?
Lillian, in 1975, you report that there were at least 100,000 LGBT people living in San Francisco alone, and they became a political force. And in other places around the country, there was a recognition, they began to recognize that, hey, we can vote, we have consciousness about these issues, and we can find politicians that will, you know, support our issues. Of course, Harvey Milk was one of those people. But it was Willie Brown that pushed through the legislation to repeal sodomy in California in the mid-70s. And there were some reactions around the country in that regard, but other states had joined in. So where do we stand with that today?
Well, the sodomy laws were repealed federally in 2003, and that was absolutely crucial. It was a case called Lawrence v. Texas. It was crucial for all gay and lesbian people, even for lesbians, although technically lesbians couldn't commit sodomy. Sodomy was defined in some places even as oral sex. And by 2003, there were only something like 11 states that still had sodomy laws. But the point is that sodomy laws criminalized gay people. It associated homosexuality with criminality. And not only gay men, but lesbians were affected by it. For instance, if a gay or lesbian couple wanted to adopt, in many states they had a problem because they were criminals. Of course a child wouldn't be put in the household of a criminal. And so it was very important that those sodomy laws finally be repealed. California was a leader. In 1961, actually, Illinois had repealed its sodomy laws, but almost nothing happened until the late 60s, and then Connecticut repealed its law, and in 1975, as you point out, with the wonderful help of Willie Brown and George Moscone, who was in the Senate and very pro-gay, sodomy laws were repealed in California, but many states continued to have them. Slowly they were repealed in one state after another, but they needed to be off the books altogether, and that didn't happen until Lawrence v. Texas in 2003.
And Lillian Faderman, since we're speaking of the Supreme Court, let's fast forward to the marriage decisions. In 2013, the High Court says the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional, and it also overturns California's Proposition 8 on procedural grounds. Then this past June, at the end of the 2014-2015 term, the court rules, albeit 5-4, in Obergefell versus Hodges, that the state laws limiting marriage to opposite-sex couples are unconstitutional. Now, would you say that even though the vote was 5-4, that by this time the court really had no choice because four of the circuit courts had already said that these laws were unconstitutional and 36 states were already granting marriage licenses? In other words, society had changed and the court really had to go along. Would you say that's the case?
I think that that's right. Polls indicated by then that over 60% of those polled said that they were supportive of same-sex marriage. I think that it was understood by most of the judges, and most importantly, Anthony Kennedy, who was the swing vote, that society had changed. And because society had changed, laws should go along with that change.
Lillian, one of the exceptions that has come to play now is that there's somewhat of a religious exemption to discrimination. If a company has strong religious values, that they can discriminate against LBG people and they can get away with it. Is that still kind of an open issue?
It's still very troublesome. Not too long ago, Indiana and Arkansas had tried to pass what they called a Religious Freedom Act that would permit florists and wedding cake bakers and tuxedo and wedding gown makers to say that they had a right to refuse to serve couples, same-sex couples who wanted to get married. The legislatures in both states had actually passed that law, and the governors of both states, Mike Pence in Indiana and Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas, were ready to sign that law into effect. And fortunately, there was such a huge protest led incredibly and wonderfully by businesses that they had to back down. In Arkansas, Walmart protested, and Walmart's, of course, is the largest business in Arkansas, and Governor Hutchinson backed down. He said that he would not sign the law that would discriminate against LGBT people, and so it was modified. The same thing happened in Indiana. Salesforce.com had just put in billions of dollars in a business in Indianapolis, and its CEO, Mark Benioff, said that he would really cut his business in Indianapolis if that law went into effect. Angie's List, which is based in Indianapolis, protested. Many other important businesses protested, and Mark Pence backed down, and the law was modified so that it could not discriminate against gays and lesbians. But as we see in Kentucky, for instance, the right is not giving up. Kim Davis, who was the county clerk in a Kentucky county, refused to marry same-sex couples, and she's become an icon for the religious right.
We're speaking to you in early November. Election Day has just recently passed, and one notable development took place in Houston, where the voters overturned their local non-discrimination law, which was called the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, or HERO, and some in that campaign to overturn it claimed it would allow men to use women's restrooms. And this, even though Houston has elected an out lesbian, Annice Parker, as its mayor, what do you make of this?
I think that our battles are not over. I think that the religious right is going to find any way it can to sabotage the progress of LGBT rights. You know, once the Supreme Court voted in favor of same-sex marriage, I think a lot of the LGBT rights organizations were saying that we've essentially won, at least for lesbians and gays, but all of the energy now has to be turned towards transgender people. But we haven't even won for lesbians and gays. I think the progress we've made has been phenomenal, but this is going to take constant vigilance. I think that we can't let our guard down in any way. And in Houston, the big excuse of the voters to take away LGBT rights was the bathroom phenomenon, that biological men would use women's bathrooms. But that was merely an excuse. The ordinance was so much bigger than who would use what bathroom. But that was the hysterical excuse that the right pounced on. And unfortunately, the voters went for it. So we need to find bigger and better ways to fight what the right is bent on doing to us. They would really like to take away all the progress that we've made.
Lillian Faderman, we're joined in studio now with Caitlin McCoy, who's welcome back to the Project Censored Show, Caitlin. And she's with Marin Students for Social Justice and an LGBT activist there. And I'd like to have a conversation, bring her in, have a conversation of what are the continuing issues and things that need to be addressed for LGBT people.
So thank you for having me. One of the huge issues that Students for Social Justice has been working on, and that we've actually encountered some resistance, has been on gender-neutral restrooms. One of the things that happens when a person is transitioning or has transitioned is they wish to use the restrooms either assigned to the gender that they have decided that they are, which is completely fair, or in a lot of cases an administration will decide, well, we can't put them in that restroom, so instead we'll put them in a neutral restroom, which is a band-aid over the problem, but happens. At College of Marin, we've been having a lot of trouble getting gender-neutral bathroom signage, despite the fact that we have gender-neutral bathrooms in existence. So that is definitely one issue, and that's something that occurs more along the lines of in education, transitioning students in school, things like that. It's not necessarily something that people consider very much as far as like a public space issue until it becomes a, oh no, men are going to use the women's restroom problem, which is a complete farce. So that is transgender issues, the right for transgender people to use whichever bathroom is necessary for them is a big thing. Also, transgender health and transgender rights when dealing with injury or medical attention or even death. This year has been incredibly tragic as far as the deaths of transgender people, specifically transgender people of color. And while it is definitely great that we've put all this focus and attention on marriage equality, there are definitely places where it lacks the coverage for everyone, and we need to focus on that as well.
Lillian, your book documents quite well the advances that have been made. no longer is the psychologists and psychiatrists that consider LGBT as some sort of a disease. Gays have the right to marry, open LGBT people in the military to varying degrees. It's still a lot of discrimination. What are some of the real issues, and we'll bring Caitlin back into this, what are some of the real issues that you see occurring in the immediate future?
I think, as I said, that the battle is by no means over. I think that reactionaries are reacting, as we see. I think that we're still not safe in various ways. In many states, you can marry on Sunday and be fired on Monday. We still don't have a non-discrimination act in terms of employment that's federal. In 1974, Congresswoman Bella Abzug wanted to present to Congress something that she called the Equality Act. She presented it in 74 and 75. She couldn't get much traction. What the Equality Act would have done essentially was added LGBT people to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. That still needs to be done. We still need an Equality Act like that that would protect us in all ways, just as other minorities and the disabled and women are protected through that Civil Rights Act.
Now, Lillian, earlier you spoke about the influences that the social movements of the 1960s had on the gay rights struggle. What do you think other social movements today can learn from the battle for LGBT rights?
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was really a politician, but I think his heart was ultimately in the right place in terms of gay people, once used this very interesting phrase when same-sex marriage was defeated in California through Proposition 8. For 6 months in 2008, we were allowed to get married, and Proposition 8 took that possibility away. He talked about himself as a weightlifter, and he said that what he learned is that he just, as a young man, that he had to keep on it and on it and on it to lift weights that seemed to him impossible. And I think that's what gay people have learned, that we have to keep on it and on it and on it. And his point was that's what we had to do in terms of the marriage question, and that's what we did do. And I think that's the only way to achieve rights, to keep on it and on it and on it, and not think that the battle is won because we've won one little skirmish, but to continue until we really do get equal rights and justice as all Americans deserve.
And I don't particularly think that any group that is being oppressed in any particular way would not think that they need to consistently be on it and on it and on it. No one sits back and goes, well, this system isn't going to work and I don't think it's going to change, so I'm just going to hang out over here and not deal with it. 29 states lack explicit protections for LGBT individuals, and 32 states lack explicit protections against discrimination based on gender identity. So as you were saying, someone can get married on Sunday and then get fired on Monday. It's very real in our country. We have not come up with this one-size-fits-all solution. We also need to focus on not just marriage equality, but for having families be recognized no matter what the structure of that family is. You're talking about people who are elderly caring for each other who may not be in a recognized marriage situation. You're talking about extended families and families that are comprised of multiple adults who may or may not be romantically, sexually involved. These families also need to have those protections. These families also need to be recognized by the state as having all of the rights that come with, like, a standard heteronormative or now even a gay or lesbian couple as well.
Lillian, with your perspective as a historian, what do you think lies ahead for the young members of our LGBT community, like Caitlin? What battles will they be fighting? It seems like transgender people are often the last ones to be granted rights.
Yes, I think that's a crucial battle, but I think that they can't afford to be complacent in any way. I think that all the progress that we've made in recent years can easily be taken away. An administration that's hostile to us, that a president that will appoint members of the Supreme Court that are hostile to us, of course, all of our progress can be reversed. So I think it's going to take constant vigilance. There's no room for complacency. My generation and the generation after me, we've won the battle for the time being, but I don't think we've won the war into perpetuity. I think young people have to be vigilant and continue the battle.
And we've been speaking about U.S. history. You wrote about U.S. history. What countries do you look for as examples of genuine equality for all of our community?
Certainly countries in Europe that are doing remarkable things. Ireland, for instance, had a popular vote on same-sex marriage, and they voted yes. I don't know that a popular vote on same-sex marriage would do as well in the United States, despite the fact that over 60% of voters in polls said that they support same-sex marriage. I fear that if it came to a vote, the right would do the sort of thing that it just did with the HERO legislation, the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance. They would find ways to sabotage whatever the electorate originally felt positively about gay and lesbian people. I think that Germany has certainly been very good in supporting LGBT rights. France has been good in supporting LGBT rights. And we've gone very far, I think. But as I say, that can easily be reversed. The balance in the Supreme Court is just so fragile now. If we lose Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for instance, and a right-winger is appointed in her place, we could lose everything. It could easily happen, I think.
But as we were saying earlier, don't you really think that the society has moved so far that it's too late for courts or politicians to try to turn back the clock?
I would love to believe that, but what's happened in Houston just recently with the repeal of the Equal Rights Ordinance there would suggest that that's not the case. Anise Parker was voted in as mayor three times in Houston. It would really seem that there's just such sympathy in that city for the LGBT community, and yet the right really managed to pervert the meaning of the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance so much that it lost practically 2-1 when it came to a popular vote.
Certainly, continued social movements and addressing these issues are going to be vitally important around the world. And we even have a pope now who's more accepting of all people, and which is a dramatic change, even though he's not so overt as to say it's not a sin anymore for LGBT people to engage in sex. But I don't see us reversing, although there will certainly be setbacks and repressions in various places and along the line. It's not like that could ever happen. We're not going back to slavery. We're not going to go back to those kinds of things. If we do, we don't really have a world or a country anymore anyway. So it seems like moving forward for freedom for people, democratic movements, and human rights are vital, and certainly supporting that seems really important. So you have a strong human rights agenda here, I hear you saying, Lillian.
Oh, yes. I think that the beginning of the LGBT movement was based on the understanding that gay and lesbian people, or homosexuals, as we were all called, were an oppressed cultural minority, and they were analogous to other oppressed cultural minorities. And I think that the inspiration for the gay movement from the beginning has been other minorities and their fight for civil rights. And just as other minorities have been an inspiration for LGBT people, I think LGBT people will and should be an inspiration for subsequent fights for human rights.
Lillian Vaderman, I certainly thank you for joining us today on the Project Censored show. And Caitlin McCoy, thank you very much for returning to Project Censored and helping us with this very important topic. The book is The Gay Revolution, The Story and the Struggle by Lillian Vaderman. It's just out in 2015. And a remarkable book that I had the opportunity to go through, and history is there. And it gives a deep understanding of what's been going on. Human rights for all of us is very important, and we have to continue to maintain and support that struggle. Thank you very much, Lillian.
Thank you, Peter.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show at Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer and co-host today, Anthony Fest. The Project Censored Show airs on 25 stations around the United States. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized, alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love with our brothers and our sisters. System. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want to crowd that.